Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Hi, welcome to this week's edition of Blues Talk. We have John, Dave, and myself. We're going to look back over Ireland's victory against Scotland last weekend, all the other final round matches of the Autumn Internationals, and of course look forward to Leinster's first Heineken Cup match of the new season. So lads, 31-16 against the Scots in the Aviva. It was a good result. I think the team, and particularly Farrell, needed a victory.
Green shoots, Brian. Green shoots.
Yeah, because Scotland were quite happy with how they've been going in the Autumn Internationals. They'd beaten Wales. There was an air of confidence about them. And, you know, it's hard to know what they're basing it on. I think Eddie O'Sullivan was pretty accurate in his assessment of them afterwards. They talk a good game, but they don't play one.
Oh, well, the statistics bear that out. I mean, I was in Croke Park in 2010 watching them. Kind of stole that game, really, with a controversial penalty, which, to their eternal shame, all the crowd booed. Which Dan Park slotted over to win the game, and I think it was a possible triple crown for us, which was important for some reason, although it was the year after we won the Grand Slam. So yeah, it wasn't it hasn't been a happy hunting ground for them in the professional era, playing in Dublin. So yeah, what do they base their, like, they're a kind of frustrating team, Scotland. Like, on one hand they're fighting it out with Italy at the basement level of the Six Nations, and on the other hand, they're one of those on their day teams. Like, on their day, they can, you know, they beat Australia in the rain a few years ago in Newcastle in New South Wales. They've had a few close calls with the All Blacks. They're one of those teams that if you catch them on the right day, they can make bits of you. But I don't think they have the pack. I think they have had the pack since back in the 90s when they had some serious pipe hitting lads. So I was happy to see the second half, and like I said, there were maybe a few green shoots. But you know, in one side of the opinion, you're going, well, there's a paper over the cracks. On the other side, you're going, oh well, you know, Farrell's bedding in his new stuff now, but. I'm leave the jury out for a while on Andy Farrell's leadership. I mean, you can't be consigning him to history at this early stage. But, you know, give him another Six Nations to see how he gets on. The bad news is, though, England and France are really coming good. And that puts us in such a bad position because, you know, every year we have the two of them away. And then in the other years, they could come over and conceivably turn us over, and then we have to win all our away matches to do anything, you know. So we're really back to where we were.
Sure, it was always like that. I mean, people talk about England and France moving away, and people have been talking about England and France moving away since the early 90s, and England and France haven't moved away. You know, at the end of the day, going back to Andy Farrell for a start. I mean, there's a load of opposing views on him, and they're all kind of right, but at the end of the day. Since the World Cup, there's been a significant turnover on the pitch. There's been a massive turnover off the pitch. And that's not something that beds in the space of 6 months. I mean, that takes time to bed in. Takes time. Obviously, we don't play the same way as we do under Joe Schmidt. So that takes time to get across. So, you know, anything would be... It would be very, very... it would be a bad choice, a bad rush decision to make any decision about Andy Farrell based on what we've seen so far. After the Six sure. Nations, after the summer tour, if there is one, when he has a chance to get not even his first choice players, but a lot of his first choice players and some others together, that's when you can maybe start to make a decision on him. There are things about the Irish team that, you know, look worrying. There are things that look good. it's gonna it we're not gonna know for another, you know, 6 to 12 months. We have England and France in Dublin next year in the Six Nations, I understand. And although that could, like everything else, it's subject to change. That would generally be a year we'd target for a championship. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes in that. I don't expect. I mean, both England and France have kind of managed to peak a year or 2 years too late for the World Cup. So
when England got to the World Cup final,
England get to the World Cup final. No, that's a fair point. But they are at a peak at the moment.
France should have beaten Wales in the quarter final, only that their captain decided to commit Harry Carey and got himself sent off.
Yeah, France do that a lot.
I think England could have won that final if it wasn't for
Sinclair hadn't got injured.
Exactly, yeah. Losing their tight head prop early. I mean, you can't account for that. You know, I think they were going well. They thrashed the All Blacks completely. They were
I don't know. I think Razzy Erasmus set a trap for England and they walked right into it. But look, in terms of Ireland, I'm not sure we're quite where we need to beat England and France, but we're not a million miles away. And France are still prone to doing silly things, whether it's young players or experienced. Like you talk about the World Cup and their captain getting sent off. Then you talk about what happened the other day, where they lost a game. It seemed inconceivable that they could lose because they were so good, and they really were so good. For 80 minutes plus, for nearly 2 hours, they were the better team. But when it counted, they weren't. And that's what often happens.
But they just have this propensity to possibly commit suicide, regardless of whether they do actually follow through with it or not. Do you remember, I think it was the day that we beat Scotland and Murrayfield to win the championship, probably 15, was it? And they played England in the Stade de France, and they decided to run the ball from behind our line. And while to the neutral observer, it was probably, oh my God, this is great stuff to watch. For all the Irish people, it was hide behind the sofas while they decided to, you know what I mean, and chew your fingernails then. But like, that's just what they do. And even in the match on Saturday, like they had an opportunity just to kick the ball out just before half time of that. And like they decide, you know, let's run. And they gave away a penalty, which Farrell subsequently missed. But, you know, it's sudden death. And Farrell missed it, sure, okay. But he, you know, you would say Owen Farrell over the course of his career would probably get that
9 times
out of 100.
Well, he had a bit of a bear. He missed four kicks.
Seen him kick so badly. but, I mean, it has to be said, it was a great game. It was certainly the game of the weekend. It was probably the game of the year. In terms of rugby, it was.
Well, in fairness, the bar wasn't set that high in a match that we didn't cover because we didn't.
Are you saying that game was better than Ireland Georgia, Jason?
I didn't really want to have to bring it up, but I think just to tick the box, we should. Like, that was one of the worst rugby games I think I've ever watched.
It was dreadful.
Ireland Georgia.
Yeah.
It also I'm sad to say, but it probably also was the final cap Finlay Beelan will get. He was on a hiding to nothing, though. He was picked on the wrong side of the scrum. And it just didn't seem to make any sense why they continued with him for so long on left-hand side of the scrum when, like, they had other options there that they didn't bring on.
Like Eric O'Sullivan, who came on
this week.
Yeah, well, look.
I thought it was a strange decision because it's not okay. We do have injuries, but it's not a position we're lacking in depth in on that side of the scrum. I mean, as you say, there's Keane Healy, there's Eric O'Sullivan, there's Dave Kilcoyne. You know,
even his colleague in Connacht.
Yeah,
Buckley.
Yeah, they have better options. I presume Farrell was going to use a game that they knew they were kind of going to win. Unless they did something outrageously stupid, that they were going to beat Georgia. And I presume he decided he was going to use this game because Georgia have a tough enough scrum. Not as good as it used to be. I mean, it's been fairly well shunted around by most during the autumn internationals. But it was a tough enough scrum, and they decided to see if they could run some minutes into him at loose head. It didn't work. He's not a loose head.
Like, it reminded me of when Tom Court came on in Twickenham in 2012. You know, it's not his fault. Like, I mean, you might as well pick a man on the street to play that position just because he plays on the other side of the scrum. It's, people don't really realise how different, how fundamentally different tight head and loose head is. Sure, you're in the front row of the scrum, but really what you do are polar opposites.
Literally. And,
literally the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, like, it's kind of unfair. It's not like saying, oh, well, I'm sure a left winger can cover on the right wing or a first centre can cover a second centre. They're two entirely separate positions. And, you know, he was put in a very unenviable and quite unfair position, really.
But, like, and you know how bad it was? Even you're defending them, Jay.
No, I know that, but like I just don't think he was, like, it's like anybody. If someone was selected to play for their country, you're going to do it. But really, somebody should have said to him, you know, pull out, because it's not a good career move for you to play on the wrong side of the scrum.
I don't know what Dennis Buckley has done, actually, because he's a kind of a canny loose head. He's very low center of gravity, and he's a guy that just, his face never fitted with Joe Schmidt for a start.
No.
Why, I don't know. But, you know, maybe it's just they don't think he can make the step up to international rugby. I don't know. I mean,
it's hard to know.
There were big questions over Kilcoyne scrummaging for a long, long time and how illegal he was and how his arse was pointed at the touchline every time he got into a scrum and all that kind of stuff. But, and he seems to have come through a lot of that with experience. But I don't know. I don't know what Buckley has done to not get a shot even. Like, you know, the fact that his own teammate at tight head is getting a shot ahead of him at loose head obviously means, you know, or maybe they just wanted to, like you say, they just wanted to rule that option out. And go, yeah, we've seen him, forget about it, move on. And now you've got the like of Eric O'Sullivan, who, when he came on, they said he's 26. I thought he was younger. I mean, I thought he was, I'm kind of shocked that he's 26, because I think
I didn't think he was that old either, to be honest with you, John.
Yeah, maybe he's not, but maybe I misheard, or maybe they missed.
No, I remember them saying it, John. I remember having the same. Same kind of eye widener as you did.
Because I think of him as being maybe 24, 23, 24.
As we all go for Wikipedia.
Yeah, off you go. I'll waffle and you look up Wikipedia. But yeah, generally that game was one to forget. It wasn't quite as bad as the 2007 World Cup game.
He's
against
25.
Is he 25? Well, okay.
He's 25 in November.
Well, he's only just gone 25, yeah. So yeah. There you go. That's more like it. Yeah. So yeah, it didn't rival the 2007 game against Georgia in the World Cup, which was really shocking. But it was still fairly shocking for at least half of the game.
The thing that concerns me about Ireland is I'm sure people who are more versed in analysing rugby than me might have a clear idea, but I don't see any game plan. I don't see any coherent. I don't. If you ask me how do Ireland play, I couldn't tell you. If you ask me how do Ireland defend, I couldn't tell you. There were points against Scotland where it was really harem scarem stuff in defence, and it was a lot of it was just individual guys making individual tackles. There were points where there was no real coherent, you know, defensive plan. And I think the one thing
like
I was...
We don't know when to go wide, Dave. Like, particularly in the match against... practically all the matches, actually, this series. But they seem to want to take it on in the forwards and try and... It's like a macho thing, trying to outdo their opposite number and steamroll over them when there's... clearly an overlap outside them, like particularly against, I think I've said it now for the third time, when we played France and they had a man in the sin bin and Keen Healy scored. Like, okay, he eventually scored, but make hard work of that and you run the risk of, you know, getting spilled over or getting held up or whatever. And like, there's always going to be a man over when there's one when their fullback is in the bin. And we just seems to be reluctant to put width on the ball. And, you know, when we do, we've got some very good players that, you know, can make insightful passes. I mean, we even saw Peter O'Mahony give a beautiful pass to Keith Earls on the weekend. You know, but like, if the ball is out there, let them bloody use it and run it. Well, instead, we seem very wedded to trying to take them on and bash them through the centre and through the middle.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned fullback. One of the things that was absolutely stark after the first half of England-France is what a difference having a proper fullback makes. Bryce Doolan for France was superb. And the way he read the game, the way he controlled the backfield, the way he took England's kicking game away from them because he was there. And you compare that, and it's, I mean, again, Jay, it's like you were saying, to a certain extent, it's like you were saying about Beelum. They're trying to put a square peg in a round hole with Stockdale. I don't think he's a fullback. I think he's a winger. He's a devastating winger. He's been very successful on the wing. He's not a fullback. He doesn't play the way a fullback should play. And I'm not talking about with the ball in hand. I'm talking without when the opposition has the ball. The fullback has a very, very vital role. He patrols the backfield. He cuts off the kicking options. And because Stockdale isn't by inclination or nature a fullback, he doesn't do that. And the difference between Ireland and France with Doolan at fullback was stark.
Do you remember?
Pick Zeebo, Dave.
I would pick Zeebo because Zeebo's a fullback. Zeebo plays as a fullback's role. He reads the game really, really well. Does stuff like that. I'd have Zeebo before Stockdale at fullback. I really would. I'd have
bring it back to Munster, Dave.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. We know now after Nusa Four gave one of his State of the Nation addresses there a couple of weeks. Was it last week? Those guys ain't playing for Ireland.
Sorry, John.
I would have any fullback who's playing for any of the provinces there because it's a specialist position. You play a specialist there.
Well, he has been getting a bit of game time at fullback, but here's a perspective on it, right? Do you remember Robbie Henshaw playing fullback for Ireland? Another fairly big guy, like Stockdale is 6'4", and, you know, I think Robbie Henshaw is about 6'3". They're both fairly well built. Robbie Henshaw is a fairly big, hefty centre. Stockdale, maybe not quite as thickly built as Henshaw, but, you know, an inch taller and probably similar weight. You've got to cover a lot of the backfield in defence at fullback, and having all that extra muscle on you is not necessary. Remember them saying this about Robbie Henshaw when he had to cover there, because when he used to play fullback originally, he was lighter and had less muscle on him. So
yeah, but baptism of fire that day. Sorry, John. He had a baptism of fire that day. Like, sure, he hadn't played fullback for 3 or 4 years, and also, well, maybe not 3 or 4 years, but certainly 3 years. And he, you know, he was playing against an England team that was in tip-top form that season.
That's true.
You know, he wasn't playing, let's say, Scotland or Wales. He was playing England when England were absolutely unplayable nearly that day.
And Rob Kearney wasn't exactly a scrawny midget.
No, but Rob Kearney is 6'1", and he's not a feckin' bodybuilder. Like, you know, he's big for a human, but he's not big for a rugby player.
You don't have to carry all that weight all that far if you read the game properly, and that's the problem. The problem is absolutely the reading of the game.
Absolutely,
and you play specialists in specialist positions.
I agree.
And that's what I mean. Okay, it was a good idea to try and fit Stockdale into that fullback position. He's a very, very good player, and it's one position where we do actually have a fair bit of depth is on the wing in terms of quality. So maybe trying to convert him to see if he would work out a fullback wasn't the worst idea. It doesn't work. We'd be better off with someone like Dave Kearney, Andrew Conway, Shane Daly, Mike Halley, just a proper fullback, somebody who reads the game properly and plays it. And it will give the defensive line a lot more security. It would also allow the scrum half playing a sweeper role to not be so worried about what's going on behind him.
He seemed very shaky under the high ball too. They put up maybe, and the way the game has gone, I mean, I'll get to that in a few minutes, but they put up a number of bombs to him, and you know, I can think of at least three that he's built. You know, like, that's not really a good enough return from your fullback. He has to be safe as a house. And if they smell blood, every team is going to do it. They're just going to stick them up again.
And he seems to switch off for something in games. Like, remember the was it against? Who was it against?
It was against France.
Where he had an awful shocker, and he wouldn't even fall on loose ball, or he seemed to everything. He had a loose ball at his feet, and a guy managed to run from 5-6 meters away and take it ahead of him when all he had to do was bend down and grab it. That kind of stuff, where he seems to not be tuned in at times. You don't want a guy like that at fullback. The whole team is more skittish when they've got that behind them than when they've got your Rob Kearney or your Gervin Dempsey or whoever behind them. You know, because that. You just don't have to think about stuff. You don't have to go, oh, shit, maybe.
Yeah, successful teams have specialist fullbacks. That's just how it works. I think it was an experiment worth trying. It's over now, please.
So let's just look at, say, Ireland in general over the last... I think we've now played 9 games under Farrell. Won 6 and lost 3, but obviously lost those 3 matches were two defeats against England and 1 against France. So, you know, the kind of the big boys are still better than us, let's say. But Farrell has brought in 11 new caps. You know, some have worked. I mean, I'd have to say Hugo Keenan, I didn't know a huge amount about him, like obviously just the bit that you'd see playing for Lens, but he's sort of come from nowhere to pretty much possibly not the first name on the team sheet, but any time he's played for Ireland, he's looked very secure, very good. And Darris, who I just think has probably made the number 8 position his for the next Six Nations if he can stay injury clear. And then, you know, there was some other caps that, like we mentioned, Eric O'Sullivan coming in. You know, I was a bit disappointed the Leinster winger, sorry.
James Lowe.
James Lowe. Like, he had a good game in his first match against Wales, and then was kind of, you know, anonymous and maybe showing up a little bit against England.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then I thought it was kind of a missed opportunity then to get some of the very younger guys coming in, especially in the first game against Wales and even the match against Georgia. But, you know, after the match against Georgia, it was the match then against Scotland was an absolute must win. There was very little experimentation and he picked pretty much his first team that were available to him, you know, because he needed that victory. And it was just a missed opportunity.
The question is, though, in the normal run of things, I'd agree with you, because a lot of young players have played very good rugby in the run-up to that tournament. The question is, how much value is there to be attached to the games they played or the rugby they played? We won't know until Saturday, because that's our first serious test of the season. You know, it's all right for, say, Jimmy O'Brien to look brilliant against... what he's looked brilliant, and he has looked brilliant. The question is, how will he go against a team like Montpellier in the south? In France. So because I mean, the value of the Pro 14 is to our eyes anyway questionable. And I'd imagine Andrew Farrell is kind of saying, okay, those guys have looked good. I mean, you've got guys like Michael Lowry, there's guys down in Munster, there's guys across the West, and you're thinking, well, it's the Pro 14.
Yeah.
And I was never one of the guys who used to say that about the Pro 14 in terms of, but this year it's just been some of the efforts by the opposition teams have been execrable.
But like, and would you say rugby in general is kind of like tonight, just when I was doing my notes for this and I flicked on to Air Sports and they showed a replay of our final against Munster from 2001. And I'm telling you, like 19 years have passed since that game. And as a TV product and an entertaining sporting fixture, it was absolutely brilliant. Now, okay, I know it was the final and it was, you know, two very strong teams, but just the way rugby was played back then compared to now, 19 years later, and I watched the France-England game and, you know, everyone will say, oh, it was a great game, but there were sections of that match where the ball was just kicked aimlessly from one end, from one fullback to the other in a game of aerial ping pong that, you know, like, only that I'm and probably the three of us are absolutely mad into rugby. For anyone who's neutral, you just switch it off. It's just not entertaining.
I rugby goes through phases though, Jason. We had a similar situation. It was 14 or 15, 2004, maybe 5 years ago, where a lot of teams kicked the ball an awful lot, and the ones that kicked it the most and the best won. And then it changed. And a lot of teams, I mean, then the offloading thing came in and teams offloaded, and the team that offloaded the best and most generally won. And generally what happens is you have a period of time, you have a regulatory shift, and it takes teams a while to come up with a way of negating it. The regulatory shift is generally to make the game more attacking or more exciting or more attractive. And it takes teams 3 or 4 years to come up with a way of negating that regulatory shift, which we've seen now. We're at that point now. And then what will happen is during the summer, the World Rugby will do something to change the laws again. And then we'll have more exciting rugby. And then in four or five years' time, it'll be back to where we are now. And then the cycle will repeat.
But like Ben Youngs came out only in the last couple of weeks and said the most frightening time for him as a scrum half is when there's a line break, because it's now become a liability. To have a line break has now become a liability because it's less that you once your player is tackled after making a line break, that you're going to secure that ball.
Yeah.
Like,
I agree completely.
It's not entertainment. If you can't make a line break and you're not secure on getting your own ball.
You have to do something about the line. So therefore, the breakdown.
We seem to be losing people.
I stunned Jason with that point.
Let you take the ball and run back at us, and you'll eventually be penalised. And once you're penalised, we'll have 3 points to kick. Like, the Lions tour to, I think it was Australia, was just so dull because all they played for was scrum penalties and kicking 3 points. You know, like, it's just not what sport should be about. And it's such a competitive marketplace now. You know, like, if you think about it, right, hopefully when everybody is vaccinated and we're all back to normal, say, this time next year, the Six Nations will sell out. But the Six Nations sold out 40 years ago, 60 years ago. The Pro 14, the interest in it is absolutely dwindling. Even a hardcore fan like yourself, Dave, is starting to have little fissures of doubt about it now. The Heineken Cup is a shell of its former self. Even when the final, if there's no Irish teams involved in it, like the crowd interest is minuscule. The coverage is hardly existent at all. It's on pay-per-view. It's on BT Sport now, which in Ireland doesn't have huge penetration. And, you know, like, something radical has to be done because the sport is not growing. It's stagnant.
Well, I always think that the way to fix rugby is look at the game and improve ways of, because the game of rugby is about a contest for the ball. And if you do things that limit the contest for the ball, then you limit the game of rugby. So if you fix the breakdown, like you were saying about Ben Youngs, like what Ben Youngs was saying, if you fix the breakdown so that it's easier for the team going forward to A, retain the ball, but also, I mean, you have to have a fair competition for the ball as well. So I think they've done too much with the ruck. It was okay about 3 or 4 years ago, and they changed it again and again and again, and until it's now, I don't know what it is. You can't play rugby with it anymore. like you say, making a break is almost liable to end in a penalty to the opposition. So they have to do something about the breakdown. You fix the breakdown, you'll fix an awful lot of the problems currently with rugby. You also, there was talk about introducing that, whatever they called it, the 50-20 or the 40-20, like in rugby league. If they introduce that, they might take players out of the defensive line, which might make a bit more space. But that to me would seem to be something that that should be looked at in elite competition, in the Northern Hemisphere. I'd like to see a change to the breakdown and that 40-20. It's 40-20 in rugby in league. I think it's 50-10 or 50-20 they were talking about in rugby union. So those changes could make a big difference.
Yeah. So looking back over the last whatever it is six games that Ireland have played. I suppose one thing that we can say for definite, Johnny Sexton is still number one out half, and we desperately need, Joey Carberry to get fit or Harry Byrne to come through. I see Paddy Jackson has been nominated for Player of the Month in England. I doubt he'll ever come back to be an Irish player, I don't know, but... As I mentioned him earlier, Darris has certainly shown that he is to the manor born as an international. But still big question marks over who's going to be our starting hooker, what our best back row is. I think, again, Gary Ringrose has to be in that side because there's no one else that can kind of create a 13. They've tried various different lads there. And I thought Farrell was a bit unlucky not to get reselected. I thought he played okay. But maybe they were trying to just look at some other guys. Henshaw and Bundy has never let the country down, I suppose. But need somebody that can have a bit of vision and create a 13.
Well, I'd say that's why this Heineken Cup campaign that we're going to talk about shortly can't come soon enough for Andy Farrell. So we can see guys like maybe Frawley, Jimmy O'Brien, Moore and Hume up at Ulster. If you see Tom Farrell across in Connacht, see how they're going. See what they're like in real competition. Because he needs to see those. He's seen them in the Pro 14, but we've discussed that. So he'll want to see them in Europe, see how they go. It's interesting. I mean, you were saying about the back row. My sense is that if Dan Levy comes back the way he was, and he looks like he is because he's been in good form for Leinster, admittedly, again, Pro 14. But if he plays well in the European Cup, he could slot in, and that would make a significant addition to the back row. For me, the real worry over the whole thing was our second row was, you had James Ryan plus an ever-shifting cast, none of whom did much to grab the jersey. I mean, Henderson came in, he played well in parts, he played poorly in parts. Quinn Roo came in, he played well in parts, he played poorly in parts. Delam didn't get a huge amount of a look in. There's young guys there like Ryan Baird, like Thomas O'Hearn. But again, Pro 14. It'll be interesting to see how and if they go in Europe before we can make any comment about them.
But I suppose that was my point that I was trying to make earlier was we had an opportunity in this tournament that really wasn't the end of the world. And rather than, still kind of having question marks over, let's say, Ryan, but I know he got injured, right? And probably it's a bad example to take because he was in the training squad. He got injured and then kind of went back to playing for Leinster. But you take my point, somebody like him, and there's probably a handful of other lads that you could, slot in various different positions.
Yeah, guys like Gavin Coombs down south and guys like that.
Yeah, exactly. And let's see what they're made of. Okay, maybe not Twickenham, right? Because that's, but like Scotland and Dublin or Wales and Dublin or even against Georgia, surely that would have been a better test for them than six games or, three matches against Glasgow seconds and Edinburgh seconds and, Dragon second. Like, really, we don't know anything further about them except that, they can be professional rugby players, but have they got it really where it counts? You would find that out very quickly if you put them in against Scotland.
I think there's still an element within the IRFU as regards the national team. I remember a couple of years, well, actually, it's more than a couple of years ago. It's probably 20 years ago at this stage. Would it be? Yeah, it would be. Well, slightly less, 15 years ago. Eddie O'Sullivan said, and he got absolutely excoriated for it at the time. He said, you know, my job is to win games with the national team. Player development is somebody else's problem. Yeah. And I think there's still, I mean, you look at the various coaches that we've had since. I mean, except for injury and we'd say the South African tour that time when there was a lot of players unavailable. So we took a lot of younger guys. National coaches tend not to do very much player development at all. I mean, we're on our, what, we've had O'Sullivan, Kidney, Schmidt, and now Farrell. And, you know, they're all pretty consistent in their selection methodology, shall we say. So I think that's it. I mean, the thing about it is, I mean, as a sporting nation, not necessarily just rugby fans would probably be more understanding, but the general tone of the nation would be, I would say that Farrell would have got absolutely slaughtered in the press had he gone full, very experimental, and we'd lost all the games. I'd say he would have got murdered. Yeah,
but again, Dave, I wasn't really calling for that either. I kind of wanted to see a hand-picked few of exceptional young fellas that hadn't really got much of a chance because they haven't been around that long, but chucked them in. Mm. And I'm talking about, you know, the scrum half then and the Coombs then, or sorry, not Coombs, the scrum half.
Casey,
is it? Yeah. You know, possibly Harry Byrne, possibly Ryan Baird, you know, possibly one or two others. And to play them in a home game against, say, a weakened Wales or
Georgia,
you know, the Georgia match.
I wouldn't disagree.
I wouldn't dream of saying, oh, let's play them in the third place final where we needed to win. Or, you know, because of the result in England and because of the poor performance against Georgia, there was a lot of pressure mounting on Farrell and obviously the matches in the Six Nations, two matches that he lost. He needed a result and to solidify his position, because if they'd have lost that match against Scotland, we would have been regressing, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas now he can say, well, we're the best of the rest.
Yeah.
You know, so no, he's yeah. kind of, you can, and you can only work with what tools you have in your, you know, what you have in front of you. Like, he can't just, but like, say, in the past, like someone like James Ryan, like he was kind of fast tracked in, and there's not many, because, you know, John often alludes to it, Irish rugby is intrinsically conservative. But when we do kind of chuck a young guy in, or, you know, like it took a while for Gary Ringrose. I think Brian O'Driscoll was saying Gary Ringrose should be picked for Ireland, and it took probably at least another season before he actually did get capped. So we don't generally go for an unheard of 20-year-old and play him. But occasionally it does work. I mean, worked with James Ryan, it's worked with Brian O'Driscoll. Maybe they should try it a couple of times more.
Worked with Johnny Bell. That's for our older viewers.
Yeah. Well, anyway, lads, turn our attention to, we've talked about Ireland ad nauseum now, so turn our attention back to Leinster. Obviously, our match, again, when we missed a week last week, our match against the Scarlets was postponed because of COVID, so we didn't obviously have a match to review last week. So, lads obviously have had a good, reasonable break. They've had 2 weeks off, and now they travel down for our first European game to Montpellier. We've got them a couple of times recently enough, but we've always seemed to come out on the plus side against them.
Yeah, we've had, what, 3 wins and 1 draw in the last 4?
Yeah.
Their best chance was the first of that series of games in Montpellier.
November 11.
Yeah, there was a last minute penalty that got us the win, or got us the draw, sorry. Y'all remember Mimouka Gogordze taking out his frustrations on the post padding. But then, I mean, they came to Dublin. Was it last season or the season before? Season before, wasn't it, John?
Yeah.
And we gave them a good beating, and then we went over to them again with a relatively not a full strength team, and we beat them there as well. Mm-hmm. So they'll feel they always won.
Was that the match that Nandolo scored 4 tries and they still lost?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was a Nandolo. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Nemzi. Yeah. He's still knocking them in for Fiji. I saw him at the weekend.
He's still playing for Montpellier.
I don't know if he is.
I haven't seen him around.
No, I don't think he is. But, I mean, whatever team they have, they'd be a good one because they're a bloody rich club. And it's actually very hard to track the top 14 at the moment because it's not really carried on any of the TV stations that I can see anyway. And it's all over the place because of COVID and stuff. I mean, they played, what is it? They played 10, lost 3 and won 7, or won 3 and lost 7. And that doesn't even account for the usual home and away split. They've lost 2 games at home.
So they're not in a rich vein of form, Dave, is what you're saying.
They won at the weekend. They beat Claremont at the weekend.
At home, though.
Yeah, but still, beating Claremont any day of the week is a good result. So it'll be interesting to see. How well prepared we are, what kind of condition we're in, and what kind of team we have on the pitch.
Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns about this competition in general and about Montpellier's part in it. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what unfolds.
I feel that one area where I feel we'd be strong is in the pack. We'll be able to put out a very strong pack.
There's rumours now, lads, that I heard a whisper of a team that will not include Porter or Healy.
Really?
So I looking at the team that I saw, I would be quite concerned. Bent Tracy Dooley front row.
Now obviously Porter and Healy are huge losses. I think Dooley's pretty decent actually.
I know they are. They're good players. I'm just saying, like those lads aren't going to play 80 minutes. So you're going to.
Yeah, well, that's true. You're going to
bring Porter and Healy on probably, but I think, you know, I think Porter played in all 6 games.
Yeah, he could give it a break.
The last 7 weeks, so maybe I'm sure that's kind
sure
of in their
be thinking. Sure, interested into New Sephora or whatever, but they might allow him to bench, which would be just about enough. You know, him behind Michael Bent and then Healy behind Peter Dooley might be enough. But you are going down to Montpellier. Okay, they're not top of the charts, but they're still a tough, big French pack down in their home patch. So I wouldn't be getting jumping up and down confident about it without those guys.
No, what I'm saying is it will be a strong pack. I'm not saying it'll demolish them, but I mean whatever. I mean we talked about the front row, but you'll have James Ryan and Devin Toner in the second row, Scott Fardy to bench there. You'll have Ruddock, Doris, and probably Dan Levy in the back row, which is a very strong back row, and we've a huge number of back row replacements that are very very strong as well. So that's where my confidence in the pack comes from, is from the guys that we do have available. I'm not saying we completely dominate them, but I'm saying that, you know, I think our back row might dominate them because it's very, very hard to see anyone having a better back row than that.
Yeah, we'll see. It's the season that's in it. There's
There's so much uncertainty. We won't know anything about this Leinster team until full time on Saturday.
Yeah.
I'm presuming that Frawley is going to start at 12, which again I'm very excited about. And it's obviously this is a very big important match for him because we've said it ad nauseum now. We've had 7 or 8 matches in the pro, 7 matches in the pro 14 or pro 12, and he looks pretty impressive. But
baptism of fire, Jason. Baptism of fire.
It's the old Frawley war. I'd like to see Frawley at 12 as well. And one of the reasons for that is it would take pressure off Johnny Sexton. Having a kicking option at 12, it would also increase. It would also split the decision of the Montpellier back row, because they'd have to cover both of them, especially if the two guys split. So you have that option as well. So it'll be interesting to see. I presume that's how they go, because Ringrose isn't back. So obviously Frawley 12, Henshaw 13 would be the obvious choice to me anyway.
Isn't there a problem with James Ryan? Didn't he get a head HIA?
Yeah, I think they're going to go with Dev Toner and Fardy in the second row and rest Ryan.
Okay.
Well, if he's any kind of a suspicion of a knock, which we may talk about later,
concussion, better to err on the side of caution.
Mm.
And then, like, obviously, you know, McGrath's been playing, starting for Leinster.
Playing well.
Gibson Park has got his first cap for Ireland.
Played pretty well too.
You know, we wondered whether anybody that would come back from Ireland camp and have to bench behind somebody that's played for and continually playing for Leinster. Like, that could be a tough call for selectors, whether they pick the Irish international or the guy who's playing pretty good for the club over the last seven games. But, you know, I suppose McGrath seemed to start the bigger games.
Yeah, traditionally has started those bigger games, yeah.
And you'd also be playing him away in France because he's seen as the Isaac Boss, rather than, I know he's nothing like Isaac Boss, but he's seen as that kind of a player rather than the speed-up player, the Alan Redden type in Gibson Park. Again, he's nothing like Alan Redden, but, you know, I'm being very broad in my descriptions here.
McGrath would be more of a forward scrum half.
Yeah, he's great at shepherding the forward. Yeah. He's very brave in defence. He's great at sniping. He's, you know, there's a lot of things to his game like that. Unfortunately, the other chap has a faster pass, unfortunately for him. But, you know, in all other aspects of the game, he would have the edge for me. But unfortunately, it's like Sean Cronin, and if he's having a bad day in the darts, he's fabulous. He's a great centre, and he's a fabulous guy to bring on to run the other team ragged. But, you know, you want the guy to hook the ball and throw it into the line out, and the rest is icing. I still see Luke McGrath starting the game though, with Gibson Park coming off the bench. We're well served with the two of them, and they do offer a change-up, depending on which way around you play them. Either whip them around earlier with Gibson Park and tire them out, which is more of a home game thing, or, you know, get stuck into them with Luke McGrath and have Gibson Park come on at the end to run in whatever we need. So, yeah. They are a good pair together in my book.
Well, I would be inclined to go for Luke McGrath, partially because I'm not saying the pitch in Montpellier is a bog, but Luke Min Flanagan has looked for special protection status for it. It's a very, very heavy pitch. It might be a game that would more suit the scrum half, that would better facilitate the forwards.
Yep. Full show.
Yep. And
The other confusing thing about A, selection, and B, what's going to happen with the Ireland Cup is every side has selected 70 players, or, you know, between 55 and 70 players, because there are really no limits.
There are no limits. You're allowed to nominate as many players as you like, as long as you nominate enough front row players.
Exactly. So, you know, it gives such a large, you know, normally you'd sit here going, oh yeah, well, they can't play him because he's not in the Ireland Cup squad. No, they're all in line, including the academy, everybody. There's probably fucking fellas who played for Leinster 10 years ago that are in the Heineken Cup squad. So, you know, we'll see how that might do something strange to the tournament as well, not just from a Leinster perspective, but from everybody's perspective, you know, and it will suit teams with a bigger squad and more money, i.e.
Here's an interesting question for you. Fullback.
Tough one.
O'Brien.
O'Keenan.
There you go. There's the two completely different answers, the two candidates. And you can make a case for either of them.
Well, Hugo Keenan has played international rugby. Okay, he hasn't played too much at fullback, but he's looking good. Jimmy O'Brien is looking cracking as well. But as Dave keeps saying, it's Pro 14 that he's looking good in.
What I like about Jimmy O'Brien is his instincts. He looks like the guy who has that proper defensive instinct for a fullback. He reads the game very well. You never see, if you look back at Leinster's games in the Pro 14, you won't see him having to scamper across half the pitch to cover a ball because he's read the game and he's there. And that's, you know, that's part of what makes an inherent natural fullback. He seems to have that. Same way as Hugo Keenan. Hugo Keenan very, very rarely has to change course radically to cover a ball. So you can make a case for either of them. I mean, what's the situation? Is James Lowe going to be available?
I think Lowe could be injured.
Yeah. So you could have a situation where
if James Lowe is injured, they want to get three comfortable lads on the pitch. So if you had Dave Kearney, Keenan has the two wingers and O'Brien at full back.
Yeah.
Whereas if Lowe is fit, then I'd say, okay, well, Keenan could slot in at full back for sure and have Dave Kearney and
James Lowe
as your two wingers.
Yeah, it's one of those selections where it to a certain extent, it's a bit like scrum half where they could just toss a coin because the candidates are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like, you know, because of the truncated tournament with only four rounds of matches, and what is it? There's 12 teams in each pool and only the top four go through. Like, that's like, there's a lot of teams going to be eliminated in those four rounds. Obviously, it's going to be eight teams. So you don't have a second chance, you know? So you kind of need, or you need to get a, I'm thinking you need nearly to win this game down in Montpellier.
It's going to be very, very hard if
in previous seasons. Yeah, and in previous seasons, a losing bonus point would be seen as a good result down in South of France. But because there's only four matches, you're thinking, wow.
Winnable's the only option.
Yeah.
You don't have a chance to make up for it in other games. So it's going to be difficult. We're going to have to go for it.
Absolutely. Well, if you don't win them all, you're definitely not coming in top seeds. You'd be looking to scrape in and out, I would say.
Yeah. Well, we just quickly have a look at some of the other fixtures. Well, just from the Irish point of view, I suppose Ulster take on Toulouse. That match was the replay of the quarterfinal from earlier on this season. I think they're at Ulster at home on Friday. So normally those matches are quite entertaining. Especially in Ravenhill on a Friday night.
They just might catch Toulouse flat in the first game. You just wouldn't know.
Ulster are very hard to beat in Ravenhill.
Yeah.
So they're
historically there.
Like, they go back they've got a winning record in Ravenhill. It goes back quite some time.
Yeah. In Europe, yeah.
And in the league as well, I think.
The last time I can remember them losing in Ravenhill in Europe was against Saracens. Jared Payne got sent off that time. That's the last time I think I can remember them. No, I could be completely wrong, but that's the last time I personally can remember it happening. They're a strong team in Ravenhill. I mean, they have a good team. They've got good young players in a lot of positions. Maybe their pack isn't as strong as they'd like it to be, but it's getting there. They've, you know, a decent front row. They've a decent selection of front row. The second row can be a bit, and the back row is a bit. But with Kutsia there, he covers a multitude. Their back line is pretty good. It's as good as anything.
Yeah, and like see Dwayne Peel is moving on.
I see that. Yeah. When his contract's up, he's going back to Cardiff.
Is he going to be head coach in Cardiff or just like another
senior assistant? Senior assistant coach. I'd say he wants to get back into the Welsh system because there might be a job there soon enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Razor Ruddock is going to get that.
Yeah.
Or Razor Robinson, should I say?
Yeah, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Mm.
Racing Connacht is one I'm looking forward to. Seeing some of the flash lads with their dicky bows playing down in the doggy poo then in Galway.
Oh, I'm sure they'll get a special the West Awake welcome.
You know they will.
Yeah.
The wind blows in different directions at the same time.
I mean, nobody wants to go to the sports. I mean, it's a lovely place. What I mean by is no team wants to go to Connacht to play Connacht in the sports ground in winter. It's a bloody difficult place to go.
Well, you know, this could be an opportunity for Connacht because, like, as you say, you're in fairly blustery conditions. It's not indoors as they play in their beautifully manicured indoor arena. It's quite different.
They'll have Simon Zeebo to tell them and what's his name, Dunica Ryan, to tell them exactly what to do.
They can see the wind coming in from Loch Atalia, so they can. It's the only place where it rains upwards.
Who'll ever forget Contepomi's penalty?
Oh, yeah.
I knew one of you was going to mention it. I just knew it.
Yeah.
2006, was it? 2007?
Actually, yeah, day before my daughter was born.
Oh, well, then you can just...
So 2008.
Yeah, it was the other match was Munster against Quinns. It's
they have a bit of a rivalry going. It's in London, is it?
No, it's in Limerick. Yeah,
very good.
You have to fancy Munster for that one. I mean, mm-hmm. You fancy Munster against Quinns anyway, just for sheer attitude. But you fancy Munster, particularly in Limerick.
Sure.
Even, I mean, obviously, they'd be without Orji Snaiman, but Day and Day's been going well for them.
Very well.
So
interesting. Sorry, go on, Dave. Sorry.
No, go on.
I was going to say, interesting that, you know, all the hype about Ben Healy over the last month or whatever, and him possibly going to become Scottish. I'm sure he's the same agent as Ronan O'Gara's kicker for the Miami Dolphins.
Scotland were trying to get him to play in the under-20s. I remember that being reported at the time.
Right. But the point I was going to make, though, was that they picked JJ for their last match against Sebre, and he turned in a very good performance. You know, like, we've seen him kind of implode, and you have to kind of admire somebody that the pressure was on him. You know, you could easily have said, right, my days are numbered, but he didn't. He kind of stuck with it. He's come back and he had a very good game. Okay, again, if you put everything into perspective, it was Zebre seconds, but he still had to do what he did and put in that performance, and puts a little bit of pressure on the coaches down there to say, by the way, I'm still here and Ben Healy isn't at all, you know. So be interesting to see what selection they go for. Personally, I'd love if they went for Healy and gave youth its head down there. Like, but
no reason why they can't go for both.
Yeah, true enough.
JJ inside centre and Day and Day at 13.
Yeah.
Of course, they have Chris Farrell as well. So, I mean, it depends if they want a Blade or a Bosch.
Yeah, it'd be hard to know. Anyway, just before we finish up, a couple of things kind of caught the eye. One was a lot of talk in the press about Steve Thompson, the former England hookers, suffering from mild or early onset of dementia from his concussions. Like, it's very sad to hear of someone only in his early 40s not remembering big matches or whatever that he played in, winning the World Cup and all that, you know. You just wonder how much hype there is now about concussion, and like, it's even sort of seeping into soccer with heading the ball, and you know, like, lots of, I saw there was, you know, obviously Jack Charlton dying, but you had
Jeff Astle or something.
Yeah, Jeff Astle. Yeah, Jeff Astle. Yeah. West Brom. Yeah.
But like, there was Andy Townsend was very involved with that documentary that's coming out shortly with Jack Charlton. And his father was a professional footballer, and his father had dementia too, of that generation, would have played against Jack Charlton in the 50s and 60s. You know, so like...
See, Cascarino interviewed about it as well, and he's a major worry because, you know, he was known for the header. And like,
he's had brain surgery too.
That's right. Yeah. Going back into the 50s, though, on those big, heavy balls they used to head, Jesus, they were, once they'd get wet, they were about 14 stone. It was like being hit with a shot put in the head. So, you know, you can see major issues there.
Yeah. But you can see attitudes have changed dramatically over the last 10 years. Like, do you remember Jackson? I think he wrote about it in his book, Bernard Jackman, when he was suffering from the ill effects of a concussion, and he got very little sympathy, it seemed anyway, from Cheka, you know, 10 years ago. Whereas there's probably more awareness of it now, and players are.
Our current scrum coach, Fogarty, as well, he was in Appleway. Yeah. Right, and he's a very kind of mild-mannered bloke in you know, off the field. He's a very kind of nice, approachable type chap. And he was, you know, turned into a narky, you know, had to be in a dark room, couldn't talk to his wife kind of for a while. Now, I think he's okay. I don't think it's had, I don't know, obviously I'm not A, his doctor, and B, don't know the guy, but I do know there were reports around not long after he retired where he was having an awful time.
Well, I mean, there's interviews in The Guardian this week with the three highest profile members of the current campaign in terms of Steve Thompson, who can't remember playing in a World Cup final.
That's pretty serious.
Alex Popham, who can't remember meeting Nelson Mandela. You know, you've got these things that because of the obviously the dementia that has onset, they're talking about, what's the phrase they use, possible traumatic brain or traumatic encephalopathy. And the reason they say it's possible is because they don't know until they're dead, because you can't tell until you're dead, which is kind of chilling, really. But you've got guys who are, and Michael Lippmann as well, you've got guys in their, you know, the 40s. These are guys who are younger than us, you know, who are suffering, and that's something. If it's even the possibility of that happening, something has to be done in the sport. I'm not sure what. I'm not a medical guy. I don't know enough about concussion. Don't know enough about TBIs to make any kind of recommendation. But something has to be done when you've got guys in their 40s who can't remember their wife's name. Right, that's not right. And if that's linked to the sport, it has to be examined and it has to be changed.
It might do something to the sport we all love in a negative way, but if that's the price we have to pay, if not watching rugby or watching a very different type of rugby is the price we have to pay for guys not suffering that kind of stuff, then, you know, what you gonna do?
Rugby.
You might see that when those guys were playing, you know, each training session was as full on as the game.
Beasting sessions.
And certainly in American football, which probably obviously there's so much more money involved in that sport, they kind of had to adapt pretty quickly. And like one thing that they did do was kind of stopped having contact practice sessions. You know, like I was just reading a little bit about Dominic Ryan. I'd forgotten about it because it was a couple of years ago, and I remember reading the article at the time when I reread it. Like he had just gone over to Leicester, if you remember, and he was tackling the big Welsh winger, George North. He got his head in on the wrong side, got a bad hit. But he was misdiagnosed. His concussion was misdiagnosed, and he was sent out to play the following week, and he got a pretty similar bang, and he ended up like never really coming back from there and played 5 games for the Tigers. But I think he ended up suing them because he didn't feel he got proper treatment by them or wasn't treated.
I think Killian Willis found himself in a similar situation with Sale Sharks.
Yeah.
You know, and these are guys, as I said, these are guys who are younger than us, and there's life-changing injuries that, you know, are... You look at YouTube and you look at the amount of best rugby hits You know, we weaponize the tackle to glorify in the velocity rather than the technique. And something has to be changed. We have to de-weaponize that and glorify in the technique rather than the velocity.
Yeah. Like I coach minis, girls minis, and you know, we've one of the coaches down in the club, he's just dying to get contact. And I'm trying to tell him we should be trying to teach the girls to evade tackling, evade being tackled, instead of
how to dominate.
Getting too caught up with them running in, looking for contact and looking to run into people. Let them look for space and run towards the space. And it's very hard to kind of get that mentality out, because a lot of the coaches, they wouldn't have played it, and they're just very enthusiastic dads. And they see, as exactly as you say this, Dave, they see it on YouTube, or they go to matches, and probably the biggest roar bar, a try being scored, is a massive hit. You know, it gets everyone on their feet and the adrenaline pumping and so on. And that's what, you know, sort of say, the new stadium fans.
We're all guilty of it. We've all done it. We've all glorified it. So we have.
It's a gladiator kind of stuff.
We all have to, you know, change our behavior or change our appreciate or change what we appreciate. For the safety of I mean, I have nephews and nieces that I want to play rugby, and I want them to be safe playing rugby. And I'm sure you're the same, Jace, with your daughter. You want her to be safe. You don't want her to be in the situation where she's in her 40s and she has, you know, a traumatic brain injury. None of us want that. We want the game to be safe for the people that we love.
Exactly. That's why I'm putting her out in the wing.
The only injury she get there is hypothermia.
Exactly. Well, anyway, boys, as ever, thanks a million. Thanks very much for watching. If you are following us on Facebook or Twitter, please give us a like and a subscription. Cheers. Thanks a million.
Fun to go twice as hard as everyone else this time of year. That's why Dunkin' doesn't stop at just one signature holiday latte. So, they made two, both handcrafted with rich espresso and topped with whipped cream. The holiday classic Peppermint Mocha features notes of mocha and cooling peppermint, while the toasted white chocolate is complete with creamy white chocolate flavor and cinnamon sugar dustings. They'll help you show the holidays a thing or two. America runs on Dunkin'. Present participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.